Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey friends, today's guest is singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist, John Oates. Together, we take a deep dive into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the smash hit number one single, Maneater, taken from the 1982 Hall & Oates album, H2O. To say Hall & Oates are prolific would be a gross understatement. These guys were churning out album after album and hit after hit, and not surprisingly, John said they never cut demos of their material. They would have an idea, be it a basic one, or something fairly worked out, and they'd take it in the studio and run with it. There was no time for demos, and with their track record, it was obvious they didn't need to sketch their ideas beforehand. I told John that I feel Hall & Oates perfectly blended their R&B, soul, rock and roll, Motown sound with the technology that was happening in 1982. Maneater is a timeless classic. A song that only shows its age to me by the calendar months that have passed. The production and mix are stellar, and the use of metaphors for the lyrical inspiration is truly awesome. So for all this and a whole lot more, don't touch that dial.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard?
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm fine, Chris. Where are you? Because I know where I am.
Where am I? I'm in the Knoxville, Tennessee area. I was just about to ask you, where are you, sir?
I'm in Nashville, so.
Oh, we're just up the road. We should have met in the middle in Crossville or somewhere and had lunch.
That's right.
Well, I got to tell you, this has been an absolute blast revisiting this song, revisiting you and your career. I could sit here and roll off statistics. I'm looking at them in my notes. The audience surely knows who you are and who Hall & Oates is. And this is an absolute pleasure. 3 days ago on May 19th, the new reggae version came out, which is an absolute trip. It's a reimagining, really, of the song. You collaborated with Rome Ramirez from Sublime with Rome. And tell us a little bit about that collaboration.
Rome is a new friend of mine. We met through his manager and good buddy Mike Cheese Brown, who's an amazing guy. And Mike and I met through the car thing. We both enjoy collecting vintage cars and things. And then I met Rome through him. And I went to Kingston, Jamaica, and recorded with some of the legends of reggae. Some of the guys who played with Marley and Toots and Peter Tosh, people like that, through a mutual friend of mine who's a Jamaican reggae producer.
Oh, here she comes. Whoa, here she comes. Watch out, boy, she's gonna chew you.
She's a leaning hungry type. Oh, here she comes.
the reason that we did all that was because originally, when I came up with the chorus idea for Maneater, I wrote it as a reggae song way back in the early 80s. And Daryl and I got together and we, you know, we adapted more of a, you know, obviously this, if you hear this single that, you know, the big hit, it has a more of a Motown feel. And, you know, so that was Daryl's idea to put that different bass line on it. But in the back of my mind, I always thought that one day I would record this as a reggae song and take it kind of back to its an original inspiration. And so this was a great opportunity to do it with really authentic, in a most authentic and way with the real cats who played on the real reggae records.
Well, like I said, everybody, check it out. It is really a reimagining of the song. It really, really takes you on a different ride. Is that how you initially heard it? Was more like it is, or?
Well, all I had originally was the chorus, you know, the, oh, mm-hmm. here she comes kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that was, and I did it with a reggae feel. But, you know, as I said, Daryl and I changed it to make it into what, you know, most people recognize. But when I went to do it again, I wanted to do it again. I not only did I want to bring it back to the reggae feel, but I also wanted to treat it as though I was a completely, you know, not involved with the original song. I know that's hard to think, but I wanted to take myself out, you know, out of that place and just say, if I was just another artist and I wanted to do a version of Maneater in a reggae style, what would I do? So I tried to really just basically, and I rewrote some of the melodies. I rewrote some chord changes. I changed the hook a little bit. And so I just wanted to make it my own, you know, my own in 2023. So it's not always easy to divorce yourself from yourself.
Well, going back and listening, I've heard this song, I can't even count how many times over the years, but when I put it under the microscope here, I'm looking at it differently. And going back and listening to this track, one of the first things that really stood out to me was how prolific you guys were, you know, all of the 1970s, but really around 77 when Rich Girl hit, Kiss on My List in 1980, Private Eyes in 81, I Can't Go for That in 1981. I always try to, when I'm researching the episodes, look for an early demo. I couldn't find one. Did you guys cut a demo for Maneater? Do you recall?
We never cut a demo for anything.
How could you? Because you were too busy, right?
We would write the songs and then we'd go in the studio and record them.
Wow.
There was no demos made. Certain songs we may have cut a track in the studio and then maybe lived with it for a night or so and just said, yeah, you know, let's go do it again. Or hey, it's a pretty good starting point, but maybe we should do it this way. But no, there was no demos. It was just write the song and record it.
I kind of figured that, again, with how prolific you guys were and as much touring as you were doing then, how would these guys have sat around to do demos? You got the idea, you're going to go cut it. So you come in with this reggae idea, and Daryl says, hey, maybe we should make it a little more Motown. Do you recall that exact time period and those talks?
Yeah, I recall it very, very clearly. He came over to my apartment and I played it for him. And he said, man, I like this idea. And he sat down at the piano and the first thing he did was go, don, 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 don. And that was his feel. He said, you know, he goes, I think this feels more like a Hall & Oates type song. He goes, I'm not sure that reggae is going to be the right thing for us to do together. And I agreed with him. You know, he was right. He was definitely right. Obviously, history has proven that. You know, I always like to joke. I'm sure glad I listened to him. you know, but yeah. And so the song began to evolve that way. And then it became the song that you've heard, you know, you hear on the record. But here again, in the back of my mind, it was always, you know, there was always this initial inspiration that I wanted to revisit or recapture. And I knew that I could go in the studio with a bunch of guys and do a quasi reggae version, you know.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to do it in the most authentic way possible. And luckily enough, I had a good friend who had worked with a lot of these reggae legends. And, you know, he said, hey, there's only one way to make a reggae record, man. Go to Jamaica. And I said,
yeah.
I said, you don't have to twist my arm. I'm there. Let's do it. So it was April 2 years ago that we went to Jamaica and did it.
That is great. Well, you guys were one of those acts, one of those bands to me that perfectly bridged the technology of the 80s. When I go back and listen to your music, especially this track, yeah, it sounds 80s to me. A lot of the reason is I was there. I lived it. I knew when it was released. But, you know, a lot of my favorite bands, I'm not going to sit here and mention any of them, Cheap Trick, they would, Rolling Stones is another one that comes to mind, but they would release records in the 80s, and they were trying to get up with the technology, and a lot of it just sounds really forced and dated now. You guys seamlessly did it to me. You know, you were experiencing things with like the Lynn drum machine and the DX7, and you were using these instruments, but it still had that backbeat swing, that Motown, that R&B soul that you were known for, and that rock and roll. It was a perfect mesh. It still does not sound forced to this ear.
Well, thank you for the compliment. You know, the technology is a tool. They've always been tools. Just like an electric guitar is one tool, and an acoustic guitar is a different tool, and you know, a grand piano is not the same as a Wurlitzer electric piano. It's really about using the right instrument and the right tool for their job. You know, you don't use a hammer to put a screw in a wall, you know. And so when we wrote the songs, there was no preconceived notion that we should let the tools, you know, dictate the type of record we were making. They were only to enhance what we were doing. And I think, you know, I think we did that pretty well. And during that period of time, especially as the 80s moved on into the digital era, it was like the end of the analog era. The analog recording was never going to get any better. And digital technology was in its infancy and just starting. And because we were so popular, we had all these companies like you said, Lindrum, Kurzweil, all these polyphonic sampling synthesizers. They were just basically giving us this stuff. Hey, try this. Check this out. See what you can do with this. And so that's what we did. We tried to use these new sounds that had just become available and these new technologies. But we didn't let the technology dictate what we were doing. It was just right here again to enhance the song.
Yeah, there's sometimes I'll turn on my Korg, my keyboard, and I'll just go to some sound I've never, you know, dialed up. There's thousands of sounds in here. And you'll just play a chord pattern, and just something about that sound inspires you to do something. So if you're using the technology as a tool and not a crutch, it can be so useful. You never know what you'll get out of it.
Well, you know, I'll give you a perfect example of that is I bought a Roland synthesizer. I can't remember which model it was. But it was my first synthesizer because I'm not much of a keyboard player, but I can dabble a little bit. And I had it in the house, and it had an arpeggiator function, and I didn't even know what an arpeggiator was. So I just hit the button, and the preset that happened to be on the keyboard was this tonal woodblock sound. And so I went and I played this melody with one finger. I just went ding 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 ding, and it became the core melody of Out of Touch.
Oh wow.
But it was because it was literally the thing that happened when I hit the arpeggiator button.
Yes.
You know, I'd love to say that was some divine inspiration, but it wasn't. It just happened. But it was a cool, unique sound, and it became the theme of the song Out of Touch.
So producer Neil Kernan, do you recall when he heard the song for the first time?
Yeah, Neil Kernan engineered it, you Padgham mixed it.
Right. So did you guys do any, I know you didn't do demos, but did you come in like pre-production? Like, hey, we got this song, and did Neil have anything to do with it? I know there was also a co-writer with you and Daryl, Sarah Allen, on this track.
He worked on the lyrics. Mm-hmm.
Right. So what was Neil's role when you came in with this track, if you recall?
Neil was really, you know, Neil was pretty much an engineer.
Okay.
He wasn't that creatively involved in the music itself. He was there to help us get the sounds right. And he was a great, great engineer. But he definitely was there to just kind of, you know, Daryl and I were both very similar in that we didn't want to get bogged down in the technology. We were all about the band, the playing, the arrangements, the singing. And we wanted to focus on that and have someone behind the board who could, you know, have it so covered that we didn't have to worry about things like that. You know, and of course, we talked about sounds and, you know, things like that, what we would use, reverbs and delays or whatever. But we weren't really into sampling at that point. We weren't really into the sampling until we got to the Big Bam Boom album. And that's when the transition between analog and digital began to happen. And we were able to incorporate some of those newer technologies.
Yeah, that's when some of the first computers were starting to do digital editing and things where you could start to move stuff around. It's nowhere near where it is today. But John, I want to get into this track. I'm so excited. There's so much to talk about. It's 4 minutes and 31 seconds. The intro, 32 bars total. It's 43 seconds, this intro, but it's the perfect setup for this song. It's basically the chorus progression here. The first 8 bars, it's that Lynn drum and bass. And man, the bass tone on this is just ripping. The second 8 bars, there's like wind chimes or tubular bells. I think they're played on a synth panned off to the left. It almost sounds like a woodblock with some echo and delay that's happening here. And another synth that's panned off right, kind of doing this flutter. It's almost something from a suspenseful a movie scene or something, like you're getting chased. Bars 17 through 24, the staccato upstroke guitar, and I wrote in my notes here, John, kind of with a reggae feel, comes in on bar 21, and we hear the sax for the first time there. There's a high one-note synth part that's running underneath everything here, that B note. And again, I wrote, use the word, it's suspenseful and haunting. It's a running theme in all the choruses. Bars 25 through 32, the sax solo is playing kind of an improvised version of the chorus melody. I'm calling that musical foreshadowing here. And then we get this big snare hit that real drums come in on verse 1. You recall how this whole came about? It's a pretty long intro, but it to me, it's the perfect setup.
Well, I'm glad you broke it down because I could never break it down that well.
thank you.
I forget how all that stuff happened. It just happened through being surrounded by great musicians. You know, when you talk about the bass, that's Tom T-Bone Wolfe playing that bass.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the great bass players of all time, without a doubt, one of the great musicians of all time, as in addition to being an amazing human being, he is sorely missed, you know, passed away a number of years ago. But, you know, his touch and his sound was just, you know, it was perfect. You know, everything he touched and played was perfect. I never, you know, played with him for years and years and years. I don't think I've ever heard him play the wrong note, ever.
That's amazing.
Mind-blowing. And in addition, he was an incredible guitar player, a great keyboard player. He played accordion. So just amazing guy. The snare drum sounds, we worked a lot on the snare drum sounds. And really, I think we pioneered a lot of those reverse-gated 80s snare drum sounds. So that was kind of a signature thing that we worked on during that period of time.
I believe Hugh Padgham, who mixed the record, he worked on that reverse snare sound on Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight and some of those Genesis tracks.
So we were, you know, it was the sound of the era, you know, in a way.
Sure, sure.
But we had a lot to do. Our early records had a lot to do with developing that sound, and here again on the Big Bam Boom album, the next album that followed, Bob Clearmountain engineered that, and he and Mickey Curry, our drummer, they spent hours and hours sampling various snare drums with different mic positions. they were in the studio like long before we'd arrive and long after we had left, just sampling and hitting drums with different sticks and, like I said, different effects. And some of those drum sounds, especially the ones that Bob Clearmountain created with Mickey Curry, I still hear those on records. They're almost like a, you know, a classic, literally have become part of the fabric of drum production.
Right. Well, this intro, 43 seconds in total, it's long.
What were we thinking? What was going
well? I mean, you wouldn't really do that at pop radio back then, and somehow you guys could get away with it here because again, this part's suspenseful, it's haunting. Yet this is as a pop song, people dance to it. It's uplifting, but there's this like that one note thing that hangs in the chorus, that high keyboard thing.
Yeah,
that is just builds and provides a tension. It's like a running theme through the song. It's awesome. That, like I said, that big snare hit comes in, real drums come in on verse one.
She'll only come out at night, lean and hungry tight. Nothing is new, I've seen it here before. Watching a wedding, she's sitting with you, but her eyes are on the door.
She'll only come out at night, the lean and hungry type. Nothing is new, I've seen her here before. Watching and waiting, ooh, she's sitting with you, but her eyes are on the door.
You know, first of all, before I even go any further into breaking down the actual lyrics and stuff, okay, we're talking about a girl, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're actually not. The man-eater, the woman, the image of a woman is a metaphor for the city of New York. This song is really about New York City. That's what the song is actually about. Daryl and I, it was inspired by a woman who was incredibly beautiful, had the most filthy vocabulary on any human being that I had ever heard. And I thought the juxtaposition of her filthy mouth and her great beauty was just too much to ignore. So that's really where the idea came from. But when Daryl and I sat down to write the lyrics, we were talking about it, and we said we don't want to write about a terrible woman or a distasteful female. We just didn't think that was cool. But what we did is we used it as a metaphor for New York. New York is the city that will chew you up and spit you out, and especially in the 80s, you know, in that jacked up decade where more was, you know, that whole Wolf of Wall Street, you know, idea that was going on. And, you know, the idea of she's sitting with you, but her eyes are on the door. Very typical of people who are shallow and people who, you know, go to a social event. You've probably experienced it. You know, they're talking to you, but they're looking over your shoulder to see who might be more important or might be more interesting or might do, you know, might be a better connection for them. You know, you know, we've all experienced things like that.
Yeah. Now you'd replace door with cell phone.
yeah, there you go. Exactly. They're talking to you and they're looking down at their cell phone. Exactly. Yeah. That's the modern version. So basically just trying to capture that, that sense of, you know, shallowness and that sense of there's always something better around the corner, you know, or something better is going to walk through the door at any moment.
I love that metaphor. Yeah. Total goosebumps right now, man. That is so cool. And from a writer's standpoint, I would love to be able to put something down on paper that is that cool. That is, you know, you obviously think it's a love song or about a woman, and you're speaking metaphorically about New York City. It's great. Again, the real drums come in here on verse one. It sounds like the vocals are doubled here, John, with a cool slap delay on the vocals. Maybe one vocal's not affected and the other one is, but it is such a cool effect.
Yeah, I don't think it's not an actual real double. It's an actual DDL that's set so tight that it's an apparent double. Daryl's never really liked to double his lead vocals. I double my lead vocals quite often because I like the sound of my voice when it's doubled naturally, and I'm pretty good at it. I do it all the time. In fact, on the new songs that I'm releasing now, I've doubled my voice on a number of them. But anyway, yeah, it's a tight delay that gives you the doubled effect.
Right, and a lot of guys would use that as a crutch back in the day. Double, triple, quadruple vocals because they couldn't sing. And we all know that John can sing marvelously. So, but I could definitely hear something double there. The first half here, we got the drums, real drums are in with the bass and the keyboards. And then we get to the second part of verse one. That staccato, clean reggae guitar, I'm calling it, from the intro, comes back in here. It is so cool. And the keyboards here, the keys, playing these big chords. It sounds like an electric piano here in the verses.
Yeah, it could be a CP70. I'm not sure exactly what piano that was. We had a number of electric keyboards in the studio at the time.
So many have paid to see what you think you're getting for free. The woman is wild, a she-cat tamed by the purr of a jag you are. Money's the matter. If you're in it for love, you ain't gonna get too far. And I had to actually phonetically spell out jag you are here. I'm assuming that was intentional.
Of course.
And that becomes a hook in and of itself. Whose idea was that?
Oh, I can't pin down who came up with the line. I mean, we were throwing out lines so fast. You know, jag you are is the way the British pronounce what the car that we call Jaguar.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
The British, the true British pronunciation for that is Jaguar. obviously a she-cat, if you look at the logo for a Jaguar car, you'll see
yeah.
it's a cat of some sort, of like a, you know, a leopard or whatever. So yeah, I mean, here again, that's just a very clever line. I'd like to say that I came up with it, but I don't know. Who knows?
She's gone. She's gone.
Hey everybody, we got lots more coming up with John Oates after a few words from our sponsors.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like this rock and
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles, The Wrath of the Buzzard, PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we celebrate and occasionally have a laugh about those bands and artists that had one song that most people remember. Although many musicians may reject the term one hit wonder, we beg to differ with their aversion to it, because wouldn't we all love to have a beloved hit song? On One Hit Thunder, we're joined by interesting guests from the world of music and comedy to dive into one artist each week. Our back catalog runs deep with episodes about everyone from Wild Cherry to Snow to Tag Team to Harvey Danger, and a new episode comes out every Wednesday. Subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your podcasts and join in on the fun.
She's gone. And she's gone. Oh, what went wrong?
And now, back to the show.
We get into the chorus, and, you know, the old adage, we've all heard it, you know, don't bore us, get to the chorus. Well, we're a minute and a half into this song, but you already get the chorus at the top, essentially. That sax is foreshadowing the melody. It's so moody. You get that high note in there at the top of the song that now comes back in the chorus. Here she comes. Watch out, boy, she'll chew you up. Oh, here she comes. She's a man eater. Oh, here she comes. Watch out, boy, she'll chew you up. Oh, here she comes. She's a man eater.
It's pretty straightforward. I don't think you need to say much about that.
Yeah, what can you say about that, John?
It's pretty straight. It's pretty straight ahead. You know, it is what it is. And the man, like I said, the man eater can be anything you want it to be. If you think it's an evil woman, then great. If you think it's the city of New York, well, then it adds a whole level of a different level of meaning to the whole song.
And it's funny, you get choruses sometimes, huge hits, and the lyrics are so highbrow, and there's so many of them. And then you'll get stuff like this song. I'll look at it on paper and go, wow, it's a really simple idea, but just the way you guys sell it, the way that it comes together with the rest of the story of the lyrics, it's absolutely genius. The "Oh, here she comes" kind of panned right and left those vocals, and it's unison. Again, I talked about it. That high one note synth part is running all through chorus one here, and those voices, the "Oh, here she comes," is that you on those?
It's both of us.
That's both of you.
Yeah, we had various techniques for doing our backgrounds. Sometimes we had all kinds of different versions of what we would do. Like, since that's a unison part, we might have done it on two separate mics to have control over the EQ of the individual voices. And sometimes we do it on one mic. And sometimes we do the first pass on two separate mics and do the second pass on one mic. So it was really just, that might even be tripled for all I remember. I don't recall.
Yeah.
It's probably tripled.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a couple of voices of each of you. And that part, you know, those backing vocals, when I got to this point in the song, so I'm now a minute and 50 seconds in after the chorus, I'm going, wow, because you guys are just so well known for your harmonies. I'm like, there isn't a harmony in this song yet.
No.
Yeah. Was there, do you remember those talks happening with anybody saying, you know what, we should put a harmony on the "Oh, here she comes"?
Didn't need it.
Didn't need it. Yeah.
You know, simple as that.
But you're Hall & Oates. How did you know you didn't need it? Well, you guys threw harmonies on everything.
Hey, restraint is the mark of sophistication.
Okay. We're gonna run with that. After chorus one, there's a 4-bar reintro that just hangs out on that B minor. It doesn't move there. There's that synth flutter off to the left, and that other synth from the top off to the right. And I notice here, John, there's no saxophone here. And this would have been a perfect time to bring that sax back. Was it ever there? Was it left out in the mix? Or was there any talk of the sax being there?
I think went out for coffee, I think.
Went out for coffee.
Yeah. I have no idea. No.
You know what, though? And the reason I ask these questions, sometimes someone will say, yeah, it was in there, but in the mix, it just didn't sound good. So I know I'm hitting you with some questions. This song's over 40 years old. But
I don't think so. If it sounded good, I'm sure we would have had it in there somewhere.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, this is technically verse 3, but I'm calling it verse 2. It's a single verse, not a double verse like the first time. I wouldn't if I were you. I know what she can do. She's deadly, man. She could really rip your world apart. Mind over matter. Ooh, the beauty is there, but a beast is in the heart.
There you go. I don't even know what to say. It's a pretty good verse, though.
It's a great verse. Now, were you living in New York City at this time?
Oh, of course. Daryl and I both had apartments just a few blocks from each other, and we'd get together and write. Yeah, and literally a few blocks from the studio where we recorded, literally walking distance. Electric Lady, I believe we recorded that. I think we recorded part of that album. No, we recorded the whole album at Electric Lady.
And what was that energy like? I mean, here's a song about New York City. I mean, obviously it made it onto tape, but what was it like being around that energy and that commotion, especially with your guys' celebrity at that point?
It was great. I mean, we could literally walk to the studio. I walked to the studio every day. It was right on 8th Street, you know, between 6th Avenue and right in the West Village. There was, you know, shops on the outside, pizza places, you know, Balducci's, great food place to have lunch or to order food. We spent a lot of money at that place.
I bet.
But, you know, it was just very convenient because it was literally walking distance from where we lived.
Do you remember when you were tracking this song in particular? Do you remember anybody, you or Daryl or producer Neil Kernan or anyone saying, this is a hit? When did you know, or did you know?
You know, no, we didn't. We really didn't. We, you know, the thing is a lot of people, you know, have always said, well, you know, you guys were the hit makers. You had, you know, some secret, you know, sauce to turn out all these number one records. To be honest with you, we put as much energy and time on every track on the record, on the album, as we did. We didn't spend more time on Man Eater or Out of Touch or any of those other songs than we did on any of the songs. We just made them as best we could. When they were done, when they were done. And we went on to the next song, and we didn't know what was going to be a hit. We really left it up to the record company to kind of come up with what they thought would be the most viable singles. And in fact, we never even let the record company hear anything we were doing. They didn't hear the record until it was completely finished.
And by this point, with your track record, you had every right to be that way. They didn't need to hear it and get in there and muck it up.
It was a different period of time. They didn't really, record companies allowed you to be creative and do what you did. And then their job was to figure out how to sell it. You know, that was mm-hmm. their job. Far cry from the way the world is today, you know, where, you know, record companies are, you know, literally involved in the creative process from the very beginning. I could never exist in the modern world of a record label anymore. But it was a different time, you know, it was a different era, and you know, we were left to our own devices, and fortunately we were able to deliver.
Well, on this second verse, the guitar is playing those clean chirps again. I absolutely love that. And going back and listening to this now, you could just totally say, yeah, I could see the reggae thing that you were going for.
The only difference is the guitar are playing backbeats.
Right.
They're not playing upbeats,
yeah.
Which is the signature of reggae. You know, so there's a huge difference there. So, you know, backbeat guitar is, you know, backbeat guitar is a staple of R&B songs, you know?
Sure, sure.
So that's not that, to me, that's pretty straightforward.
Well, talking about the bass part again, the line, she's deadly, man, she could really rip your world apart. There's this hooky little bass run that happens there. It's just so ripping. It's just so pocketed.
She could really rip your world apart. Mind over matter.
Everything that T-Bone did was tasteful and perfect. I can't say enough about his musicianship. The guy was just an exemplary musician. There's very few like that, you know.
So awesome. Well, right out of verse 2, we get into chorus 2, which is the same exact lyrics as chorus 1. And after chorus 2, we get into the instrumental bridge for 4 bars. And it's holding on that B minor chord for these bars. It's not moving. Sounds like the Lynn drum comes back in without analog drums there.
You know what? I'm going to have to take your word for it. I can't.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. The bass is also in. And again, that high synth is holding that one note, followed by a 32-bar sax solo.
Thank you.
lots of great delay. You mentioned delays earlier. You get involved a little bit. Lots of great delay and pre-delays here. Reverbs on the sax and some of the other synths that are panned left and right. John, it's moody as hell, this part. It's like atmospheric, but it's still danceable. You guys did something here that this has these elements of soul and R&B, but it was modern for the time with the production. It's just remarkable how everything here works so seamlessly. And then there's also like, it almost sounds like these little guitar scrapes with delays on them panned left and right. Were you doing little things like that too?
I can't remember that. That was probably something G.E. Smith did.
It's very cool. And again, I noticed from this part, you know, after chorus two, that progression, we get into the instrumental bridge for those four bars before the sax solo, just holding on that B minor. Then after that, it's the chorus progression for the next like minute and a half of the song. It never goes out of that chord progression. And was that a fear, or did it just feel as good to you guys then as it feels to everybody now, how this song is?
Yeah, listen, if it felt right, it was right. We didn't overanalyze this stuff. I mean, you're analyzing this song, you know, 1,000 times more than we would ever even have thought about it. We just went with what felt right, you know?
A lot of times, you know, and I'll do this, all of a sudden be like, man, I've been hanging out for a minute in the same progression. I like this. And then I'll show it to our bass player and be like, dude, you're hanging out in the same progression for a minute. Can't we go somewhere?
is it a good progression?
Well, sometimes.
Well, if it's good, you can hang out for an hour, you know?
Yeah.
It's different.
Good point. Well, again, from the sax solo out, it's the chorus progression here. It never changes. And basically, I'm not going to read through all of these lyrics, John, but there's a lot of stuff here. Basically, it's the chorus like five times. On the fifth line here, the whoa, here she comes, we get the first true harmony in the song on comes. I don't know if it's you or Daryl that goes up there on a higher note. Previously, it was all in unison. And then we get these watch out.
Yeah, the watch out.
These little, the watch outs that happen. Those are panned hard right and left. Those sound like maybe there's a female voice there. Was there?
Nope.
There was not.
It's just us singing falsetto.
Falsetto. Wow. That is so good because it ushers in a different feel here at the end of the song. You're talking about that same chord progression, but there's new stuff constantly piling on here.
Yeah.
Was that something that spur of the moment things happened in the studio? Do you remember? Or?
We just probably were listening and said, hey, feels like it needs something here. Let's try this. And we would just do it, you know.
Well, the sax solo floats in and out here. And like I said, pretty much the kitchen sink here is at the end. All of the bells, the synths and delayed noises, all those parts, they cycle in here right and left. They're coming out. And somewhere in here also, it almost sounded like, again, and it may have been your other guitar player, like almost like those high string bends, like delayed, like maybe seagull noises that were kind of coming in and out.
Yeah, that was GE, I'm sure. GE Smith, I'm sure.
Okay, it's so good. And then near the end of the track, at the 4:09 part, the song starts a slow fade out. And the very last thing you hear is, oh, she's a man eater. And the song is faded out. Fade outs were, you know, have always kind of been a popular thing depending on the song. Was the initial idea always to be faded out here?
It just seemed right. I mean, here again, you know, I'm still doing fade outs. I know fade outs aren't that popular in modern pop. But, you know, I still do fade outs. If it feels like, you know, if you've got a great chorus or a great hook going, you know, it's kind of nice to take it home with a long fade or, you know.
Mm-hmm. So the record, H2O, you know, I know you said that you put just the same amount of work into the album tracks as you did when it ended up being the singles. But do you remember getting the mixes back from Hugh Padgham and listening? And did Maneater stand out, or was it still like, hey, this is a great solid record and you didn't really know you're going to leave it up to the record label to decide?
No, I wouldn't say that it didn't stand out more than any of the other songs. You know, we knew it was good, and we knew it had definitely had a special quality to it. But, you know, after we started getting the mixes back, you know, the thing was we always let the mixer kind of get a first shot at it, you know.
Yeah.
Let them be, you know, it's nice to have, especially when you're so used to hearing this song over and over and over again in the studio and being so close to it, both sonically and everything. It's good to have a mixer who you trust, of course, take a shot at it and see what they do with it and what they bring to the original track. And then from there, we would always get very involved. We'd let the mixer kind of have his first shot at it. And if we didn't feel it was going in the right direction, we'd get very involved with a specific direction and let them do it again. And or maybe they did come up with a cool, you know, perspective and approach, in which case we would just help them refine it. And a lot of times it had to do with the level of the vocal. You know, how loud should the lead vocal be over the track? You know, in certain songs, you know, you want the vocal to be tucked back into the track a little bit more, to be integrated into the actual rhythm track. And other songs, you know, where the vocal needs to be out front. So we would really spend a lot of time we'd spend a lot of time with the panning and positioning of the backgrounds, how the backgrounds were spread. Not so much on Maneater because there's not a lot of backgrounds, but on some of the more, you know, background heavy songs like I Can't Go For That, for instance, you know, we spent a lot of time manipulating the sonic picture of how the background vocals were arranged, you know, in the stereo picture. So, you know, stuff like that, you know, just finishing touches, you know, icing on the cake.
One last thing. What was your, if you can look back now, what does it feel like, if you're able to describe it in 20 seconds, what does your life feel like from 1977, Rich Girl, to Out of Touch in 84?
Well, we had a flush of three songs. We had Sarah Smile, Rich Girl, and She's Gone, the re-release of She's Gone, in the mid-70s. So we had this, that was our first real flush of commercial success. But then the late 70s was a down period. We made a live album. We made an album called Beauty on a Backstreet, which was a stiff. We made an album called Along the Red Ledge, which I thought was musically really good, but it wasn't that popular. And then we made an album called Ecstatic. So we had, you know, we went from having these three hits in a row to having no hits. But it was an interesting period of time, because what we did was we developed a band. And we developed the 80s band that became the 80s band during that period of time. And so when we hit the 1980 in the Voices album, we hit the ground running with an amazing band. And then we started writing songs. And the key to the whole thing was we began to produce ourselves. So starting in 1980, we produced all those albums for the decade of the 80s. And that changed everything, because we made the records exactly the way we wanted to make them. So that was the key to that.
And that is so beautiful. I'm glad you said that, because, you know, that's back when labels, you know, they would develop an act. And now, if you had three albums in a row that didn't sell, a label's not all of a sudden going to let you be the producer, you know? So that goes to show you that it's just a completely different time, and it worked out beautifully for you. Before we break, John, I know this past March 17th, about 2 months ago, you released a new single called Why Can't We Live Together? If you'd like to let the listeners know what that's all about.
Well, that's a cover of the Timmy Thomas song that he did in 1971. It was an anti-war song. Obviously, he wrote it during the Vietnam conflict. And it was, you know, considering, you know, I've never been that overtly political when it comes to my music. But considering what's going on in the world with the Ukraine and just the protests that surrounded the last presidential election and so on and so forth, I just thought it was a song that needed to be rediscovered and, you know, and reappreciated. So I pulled it out. I was always a fan of the original version, which was very stark. You know, it was just a B3, a drum machine, and a vocal on the original version. And I wanted to make it my own. I put a lot of harmonies on it. I recorded a bunch of stuff on GarageBand at home. Most of the sampled stuff is the stuff that I did at home. And then I also put a very 70s electric sitar part on it.
Cool.
Yeah, so it's just it's really just a song that I felt that, you know, that anyone who didn't know the original, hopefully they can rediscover my version of it, because it's a song that speaks for our time, and it's a song that's very powerful, and it deserves to be heard again.
Awesome. We'll definitely check that out there. And anything else you'd like to leave the listeners with before we break?
Wow. I appreciate people kind of listening to this series of streaming singles that I'm putting out, and there's going to be a lot more to come. So hopefully people can check out the songs as they come out every month.
Awesome. Thanks so much, John.
Hey, man, that was a really good interview. I appreciate it.
Tell me why can't we live together?
Well, I thought that episode was amazing. I can't believe we just had John Oates on Krista Makes a Podcast. I can't wait to talk to Chris about that in the rap segment that's coming up right after a few words from our sponsors.
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name is Patrick, and usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work, but we talk about decidedly not-so-grown-up things like...
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers, think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind Podcast.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Dean Ford, a one-man dance pop rock machine from Portland, Maine. He's got a new EP out titled Dream Fever, and here's a snippet of a song from that record, VHS.
The Rap with Chris and Chris.
So, Chris, we do a songwriting podcast, and we just had the gold standard of songwriting on the podcast. John Oates was just on the podcast. That's incredible. Was it a pinch me moment for you?
I mean, yeah, of course. I'm like still kind of freaking out. My whole morning, I'm pacing around. I'm just going, you know, I mean, this is like, yeah, it's the gold standard to think that this little podcast that could, the podcast we started 3 years ago, I'm talking to John Oates. That's really cool.
Yeah, really, really awesome. You and I were on the phone earlier today just talking about the hits that John Oates has been involved in, Hall & Oates. It's crazy the amount of hits that Hall & Oates had, and this one being one of the biggest. This song is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, this this track was their longest at number one, arguably their most popular song. The song, it exemplifies everything that's 80s, but it's not a song that you can write off as just an 80s song. As I told John, it has every element of Hall & Oates. They embrace the technology. They use it as a tool, not a crutch. I can't think of a better band that bridged the 80s how they did, and it's incredible.
Well, the most important thing is take away all of those, you know, you talked about the new technology at the time, and take away all of the fancy studio tricks and whatever, and just strip this song down to its bare bones. It's still an amazing song.
It's amazing. The progression is relatively simple in this song. There's not a lot going on from that aspect. The harmonies that this band is known for, really restrained. They don't come in till the last chorus, which is so odd. You know, looking back and going, wait a second, the whoa, here she comes, that part is in unison. And I'm thinking, gosh, if you would have asked me just out of nowhere, I hadn't heard Maneater in, I don't know, a year or something, like, is there harmonies on that part? I would have said, yeah, it's Hall & Oates. Of course there is. You know, this little things really jumped out and surprised me in this track.
It's the second time on this show we've had an iconic artist who harmonies are a huge part of them, of what they do, yeah. Where the harmonies don't come in until the very end. Huey Lewis, same thing, right? It wasn't until the very end that any harmonies came in.
Absolutely. And he was actually kind of flabbergasted by that. I remember Huey saying, oh, I guess you're right. That is kind of weird for us, you know, and it is. This song, you know, something else we didn't really, I might have mentioned it briefly at the top, but you and I talked about it. This is like you're being chased. You know, it's suspenseful. You know, I'll say it again. I can't stress enough that just how simple is it to take a keyboard with one note, B, and just hold it, you know? And that just one sequence note held out in those choruses and intro part, it adds a suspense and a tension.
It is so cool. You brought it up several times in this episode. You can dance to this song, but it's also kind of eerie. I said to you on the phone before we recorded this that the title of the song, Maneater, the music sounds like if there were no words or no melodies or anything, just the music, it sounds like something, if you were hunting prey, it sounds like a man eater or something. Yeah. Like the music perfectly matches the title. That's what these guys are so good at, is like that central theme of the song, just the music matches it perfectly. You Make My Dreams. Take that song, for example. Think about the music of that. Bump, 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 bump. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel like You Make My Dreams Come True. That music itself, it's like they're masters of it. Once again, man, bringing it back to what I first said, the gold standard of songwriting. These guys, I put, John and Daryl, I put them at the top of the heap with anybody in the history of music when it comes to writing songs.
Yeah, and again, I don't know how much this means to the listeners, but the fact that they did this to analog, this wasn't done with computers. They're able to come in. These guys didn't cut demos, which wasn't surprising when John said that. How could they? Okay, look at the string of hits. They were literally getting off tour, going into studio, recording another record, and before the record's even mixed, they were probably back out on the road. I mean, they were striking while it's hot. You know, most acts know that when you're that hot, you got to keep going. You look at the runs of a lot of these bands, you don't want to lose it, you know, and these guys worked their tails off. The proof is in the pudding with how many hits they had, just unreal. And let's talk about the story here. The metaphor of New York City built around the story that everyone can relate to. You know, watching and waiting. She's sitting with you, but her eyes are on the door. You know, and that could be male, female, anybody. I've been talking to someone knowing that they're just waiting for someone to come through the door. Or they're looking at, they're hearing me, but they're not listening to me.
Right. Hey, I was going to bring this up to him. Like, no, I'm just going to thank him and let him go. But dude, when Punchline recorded an album in New York City in 2005, we recorded with these producers, Shep and Kenny, and the place we recorded was just full of Hall & Oates stuff, just everywhere. Promo stuff, records, posters. We're like, why do you have all this Hall & Oates stuff in here? I think the place we recorded was also Hall & Oates manager's office or something like that. I didn't want to bother him with that, but yeah, the New York City thing, I was like, that's right, that there was all that Hall & Oates stuff around. But hey, Chris, one thing I gotta say too, the story here about perseverance and just making music, you just brought it up a second ago, John brought it up, they had three hits in a row in the late 70s, but then they didn't have any hits for a while. Mm-hmm. And they were putting out albums and they were doing their thing. But then they kind of had a second era of blowing up again. And that happened when they started producing themselves. Like, mm-hmm. that is, to me, the ultimate story. Like, that's the perfect ultimate story of, I want to follow those footsteps if possible. I mean, well, you know, you can't guarantee you're going to have the early hits, but I'm just saying, like, stick-to-itiveness or whatever they had, you know?
When he's talking about, though, the lean years, after they had, you know, Rich Girl and some of those early hits, we're really only talking about 2 or 3 years, because Kiss on My List in 1980 was a massive hit for them. So what may have seemed like a long period of time, looking back now, I mean, these guys were releasing record after record. They weren't waiting 2, 3, 4 years between albums. It was every year, the big acts back then. That's how it went down. And I'm going to leave you one thing here, Chris, before we sign off here in a minute. Why did the grain farmer start listening to punk rock?
I have no idea.
He was tired of hauling oats.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's great.
And you could probably cut that out of here. If it does make it, then I'm going to look like the idiot. But I'll tell you one thing. We don't tell jokes like that on the after party, do we, Chris?
No, we tell much better ones than that.
That's right. If you want bonus episodes of this show, our other podcast, The After Party, where sometimes we talk about the episode we just released on Monday, other times we talk about whatever's on my mind or Chris's mind, you can get to that by going to chrisdemakes.com. Sign up for our supporting cast and get bonus episodes for the price of a cup of coffee every month, and I promise I won't tell horrible dad jokes like the one I just did.
I don't know if you're going to stick to that promise, Chris, but yeah, chrisdemakes.com is where you can go. Two more quick things I want to say about this episode before we sign off, Chris. One, G.E. Smith.
I know.
That, I feel like that was kind of like just in passing that he was brought up. If you don't know who G.E. Smith is, I knew him growing up as the guy who plays guitar on Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
Yep, G.E. Smith played on this. Pretty cool. Also, one more thing I wanted to mention, which you and I should probably at some point reenact this. The album cover of H2O, the album that Maneater is on, is one of the best ever. It is Daryl and John face to face. Everyone knows this album cover. I just wanted to say, I think it's one of the greatest covers of an album ever. But yeah, my last two little words on John Oates and Daryl Hall right there.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Give me a follow on Instagram at @lessthanchristy. And don't forget to join the Krista Makes a Podcast Facebook group. We'd love to have you. Want to thank, from the bottom of my heart, one of the coolest cats out there that I've had the pleasure of talking to, Mr. John Oates. And we'll see you next week.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street Podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
Hey you, do you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020'd.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020d.com, soundtalentmedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.